out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. I said unto their children in the wilderness, walk ye not in the statutes of your fathers, neither observe their judgments. This is By Yahweh's Design with Pastor Dan. Now here's your host, Pastor Dan.
Welcome, everybody, to By Yahweh's Design. I am Pastor Dan, your host, for this one-hour live radio program coming to you over the Heritage Broadcasting System. We're coming down to you through the Internet, C-band satellites, and for a few fortunate few, the FM rebroadcasters, our Paul Revere's for today. Also, through WRMI Radio Miami International at 7.385 megahertz shortwave. We ask Yahweh, our Heavenly Father, to bless each and every one of you. First and foremost, we dedicate this program to our Heavenly Father, Yahweh, the Father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, surnamed Israel. For all good things come from Him, and we wish to give Him all the praise, glory, and honor for allowing us this opportunity to bring His truth to His holy remnant, the lost sheep of the house of Jacob Israel, also known as the Caucasian or Aryan peoples of the earth. Hallelujah, Yahweh, all praise Yahweh in Hebrew. This is a 2-seed line racial covenant identity ministry, and we've been preaching this truth for a good number of years, but we never claim to be perfect. We encourage your participation either through calling in at the number I'll give you in just a few moments or writing to us. Tonight's program is entitled, Are Jews Parasites? My guest that I'll be introducing to you here in a few minutes is Philip Glidden, who's a PhD out of the Florida State region, and he's also the author of a book entitled Trading on Guilt, which is an expose of how the Jews are pushing the Holocaust religion, if you will, on our school children. And Mr. Glidden is actively involved in filing lawsuits to have that practice stopped, which we highly encourage. In the meantime, we want to ask that you keep us all in your prayers and thoughts, and if you get a moment, to drop us a line. Just let us know you're out there and how you're hearing the program, etc. Give us a little bit of feedback. We also encourage you to tune in on Monday through Thursday in Heritage at 9 p.m., the same time and channel, to pick up Genesis 3:15 with Pastor Bob via Heritage Broadcasting, and we encourage you to tune in. One last plug here, for your health concerns, call Dr. Judy at Salt Box Herb, and that's at area code 724-639-9607. Okay, before we go any further, Charisse has a poem, and we'll have her read it in just a second.
Thank you, Pastor Dan. The title of the poem this evening is Deadly Parasites. Deadly parasites do abound. They latch on to their host with barely a sound. O Jacob Israel, you are the host. The deadly parasites are the Jews who now boast. They suck your lifeblood till you faint dead away. Once they've latched on, they're here to stay. Unless you are willing to stand up and fight. Throw off that deadly parasite. O Jacob Israel, you are the host. The deadly parasites are the Jews who now boast. Thank you, Pastor Dan.
Thank you. You have to bear with us. We're on a remote location tonight, thanks to the Feast of Tabernacles. And we hope everybody's planning to attend a feast somewhere near your area and join in on the celebration and fellowship of this one of the three main feasts of the year. We'll be up here in the Michigan area at Fremont and encourage anybody that's near that area to come join us for our fellowship. Has Philip called in yet? Apparently not. Anyway, again, tonight's program is going to be Are Jews Parasites, and we're going to be going over two articles that have been written by Mr. Glidden.
Mr. Glidden is now with us.
Okay. Jewish Parasitism and the Extended Phenotype, and the latest article that I read, Are Jews Parasites. Both of them excellent. If anybody contacts me, I'll be glad to run off a copy and send it to you because this is really good material. And, Philip, you're with us now?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, excellent. Welcome to the program. Again, folks, this is Philip Glidden, PhD out of Florida, who's actively pursuing our main subject for tonight, the folks known as Jews and what they're up to in our society. Philip, I told him the titles of the two articles that that I'd gotten from you. Very interesting, by the way, very well written. And perhaps before we go too much further, maybe you could tell the folks a little bit about yourself. I mean, how you got involved in this struggle. And
My initial interest in this, I'm actually a geologist, a physicist, a Russian. And after I retired, I came to Florida, and my first interest in this was when I learned about a Holocaust law that was being passed in the state of Florida to require the teaching of the Holocaust mandate, actually, in the Florida public schools. And after investigating that, I went through a long process of investigating it, and I wrote a book on the subject. So that's my initial interest, and from that I've gone into other aspects of the situation and come up with this.
Oh, okay. Very good. You're also a traveler, too, are you not? I mean, you.
Yeah, in fact, I was planning on going to the Middle East this year, but in view of the problems that are having in Jerusalem right now, I think it's a good place to stay away, so I'm going to Cuba instead.
Certainly.
But I was there, as I guess I told you, before, about 3.5 years ago, and there was a lot of problems even then, and one of the bus lines that my daughter and I were on actually was blown up about 2 or 3 weeks after we'd been there. And then when we went to Egypt, a bus line was machine gun killing some 50 passengers, whom the Egyptian terrorists thought were Israelis. It's a dangerous place, even at the best time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I don't think it's going to get any better. Some of the sources I have that travel extensively, predominantly over in Africa, sort of told me the same thing about a year and a half ago, that things are very much heating up. We had over the shortwave reported a week or so ago that Israel has declared war on Iraq. Strangely enough, the major media isn't telling anybody about that. But there's definitely some trouble over there. The thing we would remind people is that this stuff going on in the Middle East is diversionary, and they had better pay attention to what's going on over here in the United States. Personally, I think it's the Armageddon scenario being played out in the Middle East is just to keep our focus attention diverted over there, and they're setting us up for some really bad stuff here. But anyway, our main interest tonight is to discuss this. Now, Philip, you go into a very in-depth analysis of what parasites are based on science, and then you make the analogy of how these people behave that way. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, sure. First of all, let me say that, let me define the word parasite. Parasite is an organism, maybe plant or animal, which derives its nutrition from that of its host without providing anything in return. So it's, in other words, a one-way street. And there are degrees of parasitism where a host only acts partially in the life history of the organism, and in other cases it provides all the nourishment for the parasite during its life history. But the interesting thing about it is that there are more parasites in the world than there are non-parasites. And most of the parasites that exist are those which cause disease, like viruses and bacteria. And the free living species, so-called, which derive their nutrition directly from the environment, are in a minority. Now, to extend the idea of parasitism to the human species, of course, is a very difficult task and one which is very, very controversial. But if you use the definition as I provided, you can see some semblance of authenticity there. If you regard the way that one group of humans exist with regard to other humans in our world society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, again, like you said, the problem with this is we've been all brainwashed and propagandized to the point where just bringing up the subject will get you labeled and lambasted. And if you treat it strictly scientifically and logically and leave the emotionalism out of it and the name-calling, as you did in this article, which, I mean, it's undeniable that these people, by their fruits, as we mentioned a week ago, the scripture tells us to judge them not by their words, judge them by their fruits, the things they do. They behave exactly like the parasites that you mentioned in your article.
Well, again, you have to, size up the situation as it exists, whether there are groups of people that derive their nutrients directly from hard work and raising food and so forth, and those that do not, but then provide it in a secondary way from the work of the primary sustainers, as it were. So, using the definitions I provided earlier, I think we can perhaps make a case here that there are parasites among us, human beings, who do derive their nutrients, as it were, from a host society. And but in order to deal with this, perhaps, we have to look back in history and see how this might have come about. Because one of my papers, I state about the extended phenotype, and I think that should be defined. This is based on a concept provided by the British biologist Richard Dawkins, called the extended phenotype. Now, the phenotype, of course, is the individual that is produced through the combination of genes from the female and the male, providing a embryo which in turn develops into a whole human being, and that is the phenotype. Now, the phenotype, in order to be parasitic, has to in some way influence a host and one way or the other in order to gain some sort of sustenance from that host. And this is where the concept of the extended phenotype comes into play. And, you know, if you think about an ordinary parasite as a disease operating within the body, this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the influence of that phenotype to extend its parasitism outward from its body to be able to encompass and control the host society. And in order, the best parasite is one which is very adept at deception. And then might I just say that the Mossad, which is the Israeli Secret Service, has as its primary function is by way of deception.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an excellent book written on this by a man named Viktor Ostrovsky, who had been a member of the Mossad, which is the Israeli Secret Service, and which he calls his book By Way of Deception. And this is, of course, the way that most parasites operate, is by deceiving the host. And we can run through an entire gambit of organisms that have been preyed upon by parasites, and the common mechanism is by deception.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you want to deceive the host into thinking or surmising that perhaps some good is being derived from the parasite, where in fact it isn't.
Well, I think that's
so. So deception is a very, very important aspect of being a parasite.
Mm-hmm. To convince the host that you need them.
Exactly. Or at least to convince the host that the parasite is not creating any damage, and in fact it's probably an advantage to the host. But
uh-huh.
In fact, it's not the case at all. I mean, there are many cases in the literature, if you study ants and wasps and so forth, you'll find that there are many cases where the both the host and the parasite have gone to great lengths over a long period of time through evolution to the parasite to deceive the host and the host to try to combat the parasite. And oftentimes it becomes a sort of a standoff, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
However, in these are things that take place over a long, long period of time, because it's the only way that evolution functions is over a long period of time for the most part. So we can't really say that there has been any definite genetic change in, say, the Jewish parasite versus the non-Jewish host as a result of only, say, 2 or 3 years of evolution, 2 or 3,000 years, I'm sorry, of evolution. And this is a aspect of the situation that is under study at the present time by many people.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
It's not a simple subject by any means. And,
well, no, it isn't. But
the interesting thing that I was trying to point out is that most Jewish scholars, or most Jews for that matter, educated Jews, will suggest that anti-Semitism is even a disease of non-Jewish people who look upon Jews as with envy and so forth and so on, and that anti-Semitism is simply an induced hatred of Jews as they're being more successful than most other groups of people. The thesis having to do with the Jews being parasites is that you will find among more primitive organisms, for example, where the host is oftentimes developing an antidote to the parasite. In the case of some wasps, they actually develop a chemical antidote to the parasite. But the parasite, in turn, over a period of time, evolves an antidote to the antidote. So this is a ongoing situation,
mm-hmm.
with neither one perhaps winning nor the other. So I suggest in my paper that anti-Semitism is, in fact, a reaction to being parasitized. That is, it's a reaction to try to remove the effect of being parasitized by another group of humans who have adopted a parasitic mode of life.
Well, as you mentioned, there's a couple things I noted. First of all, it has to be open for discussion. And the problem I see is that the Jewish community, as soon as you bring under investigation anything that they say or do, you're immediately labeled. I mean, you get this verbal and written lashing, calling you names. Of course, they'll never say that you're not telling the truth, because 99% of the time, whoever they're after is telling the truth. But you'll get labeled all these names, and a subject such as this, as you said, needs to be talked about. And
well, again, this is the deception that is required in order for a parasite to continue to be parasitic.
Right.
It would be an ideal situation if the parasite could give up its way of life, and the host could accept the former parasite on an equal basis. But unfortunately, that isn't happening. And what can the host do if indeed this is a variety of parasitism? I mean, I'm only proposing this theoretically, but it's interesting to note that throughout history, the word parasitism has often been applied to Jews from almost the first time we hear about them in history.
Well,
so it isn't anything that's essentially new.
No. In fact, Their own kind have used that description of themselves. There's writings of Jews who have called themselves a race of parasites and vampires.
Absolutely, but I mean as a scientist or a rock scientist, as it were, I would prefer to try to apply some sort of scientific investigation to this.
Mm-hmm.
There's already been some interesting genetic studies done showing that. For example, the Cohen family is essentially another term for rabbi, and genetic studies have shown that some 45% of all Cohens have similar DNA sequence and in their chromosome, especially in the Y chromosome of the male. So this is very significant. It shows that there is very little outbreeding. At least in that particular aspect of Jewish tribalism, as it were, in terms of the Jewish tribe, and that this is a very common thing to this particular group of Jewish people, this continuity of the particular sequence of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And if indeed this is the case, and it seems to be the case, then at the same time there might be some kind of genetic, part of the genetic continuity that has somehow caused Jews to the phenotype to react in a certain way, be more parasitic than not.
Mm-hmm.
So something like this might even have penetrated into the DNA, but it's difficult to say that this could possibly happen over 2,000 or 3,000 years.
But for the time being,
but, I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, but for the time being, the old saying, a leopard can't change his spot, sort of fits.
Well, I think with modern genetics, I think you're going to be able to do just about anything. I mean, you're going to be able to change leopard spots. You're going to be able to do all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you want to produce the Shaquille O'Neal, pardon me, Shaquille, I don't mean any disrespect, or a basketball team of a certain size and speed, you probably can go to a geneticist and set it all up for yourself and come back in 20 years and you have your ideal basketball team.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe the Creator is going to let us get that far, but you never know. You mentioned the fact...
If there's money to be made in it, it'll be done. I'm a little bit cynical on that
regard. Well, who are the folks so interested in money? Anyway, you mentioned that the creators, the non-parasites, typically are in a very small minority. Would that... Now, you look at the world today in history, what group of people fits the minority status of being the world's creators versus the parasite?
Well, of course, I mean, I'm a fellow with Darwin. I believe that all of the Earth's organisms developed through a long period of time, essentially about 4.5 billion years, through slow evolution, and despite what many creationists might think, my view is that that evolution is still taking place, perhaps at a much more moderate level than ever before, but nonetheless it is still taking place. And the fact that if there is indeed some change in, say, Jewish DNA as a result of inbreeding and adopting a certain way of life, which may be parasitic, depending upon our definition, I think this suggests that we cannot change that aspect of it without really finding out if indeed it is true and what is causing it. These are very, very complex problems when you're dealing with DNA, because, I mean, they haven't even finished the human genome yet to know how many chromosomes there are, how many genes in the chromosomes. I mean, we know how many chromosomes there are, but we're still wondering about all the genes and what function they have to do with.
Mm-hmm.
We know a great deal about it, but, I mean, it's going to be many, many years before we're able to determine whether or not a particular gene, newly mutated, say, in the last 2,000 years, can actually be instrumental in making a phenotype have a tendency to be parasitic.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting concept, and I think it's something that should be pursued.
Oh, absolutely. Phil, we're going to have to go to break here in just a minute.
Okay.
So when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you to go into, from your point of view anyway, what happens when a host realizes it has a parasite attacking it, what things should it do to defend itself, and do we have, as a law of nature, if you want to call it that, a right to defend ourselves from parasites who have it in their agenda to destroy us? If you think about that over the break, and we can come up with that, and also I'd like you to folks after the break some way they can get a hold of you to order your book or even just maybe send any kind of correspondence to you for some of your articles, etc. But in the meantime, we're pretty close to the break, and you're listening to By Yahweh's Design, and we'll be back right after the break.
Nevertheless, I withdrew my hand and wrought for my name's sake, that it should not be polluted in the sight of the heathen in whose sight I brought them forth.
Listen to us worldwide on hbroadcast.com. This is the Heritage Broadcast System.
Senator, your Secret Service advance teams and counter-snipers are in place. 3 plainclothes bodyguards with submachine guns will escort you to the stage.
Sounds like we're ready. Let's go make a speech.
Let's give a warm welcome to the Senator.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have come here to ask you to help me reduce crime. Turn in your firearms to the government to be destroyed.
Politicians are trying to take away your firearms. Opportunistic celebrities have gotten free media coverage by turning in firearms in front of cameras. They say you should turn in yours. Of course, they have armed bodyguards protecting them around the clock, many paid for by your tax money. Before you give up your firearms, ask yourself something. Are the politicians and celebrities paying any bodyguards to protect you?
Support this advertising. Send checks to Citizens of America, 2118 Wilshire Boulevard, number 447, Santa Monica, California, 90403, or go to citizensofamerica.org.
Be it a spill, accident, war, or terrorism, potassium iodate will protect you, your children, and your pets by blocking the thyroid and preventing it from absorbing radioactive iodine. Youngsters are extremely susceptible to thyroid cancer after exposure to radioactive contamination. Medical Corps is now offering the easier-to-dose potassium iodate. Each factory-sealed bottle contains 285-milligram potassium iodate, which has an unlimited shelf life. Each bottle of potassium iodate is $24.95. Or for orders of 4 or more, each bottle is only $22. Send your payment today to HBS, Post Office Box 5583, Evansville, Indiana, 47716. That address, once again, is HBS, Post Office Box 5583, Evansville, Indiana, 47716.
Broadcasting worldwide, this is the Heritage Broadcast System.
Welcome back to Yahweh's Design with Pastor Dan. Now here's Pastor Dan.
Welcome back, everybody, and again, you're with Pastor Dan, and this is By Yahweh's Design, and tonight's topic is Our Jews Parasites. My guest is Philip Glidden, Ph.D., out of Florida, who authored Trading on Guilt, excellent little book exposing the Jewish agenda to force the Holocaust religion, if you will, on our children. And I salute Mr. Glidden in his struggles to end that nonsense. And let's pick up then, Phil, where we were talking about a host who has been invaded by parasites. I think personally we have a lot of parasites, if you want to talk about the United States at the moment anyway. But most specifically, I think the most dangerous because of their power and control of the media, which allows them to create the deceptions that are so necessary to be successful parasites. What, in your opinion, is our hope? I mean, what now? Those of us who know our identity, of course, we're probably going to disagree with you slightly. But from your standpoint as a scientist, pure science, what does the host do to defend itself from this attack of these parasites?
Well, of course, the first thing to do is to be able to recognize whether or not there is indeed any credibility to this particular idea. I mean, this is simply up in the air. I mean, so in order to gain some sort of credibility, perhaps, it might be of interest to take a portion of the country, as I did, say, the state of Maine, which up until World War II, a little after, had a very, very small Jewish population. And it's well known that Jews in a population where they are in a great minority, keep a very, very low profile. This is tradition. However, following World War II, a number of survivors of the Holocaust were able to come to this country as refugees, and many of them settled in the state of Maine. And, of course, it's interesting to note that the word Holocaust in American lexicons did not come into usage until it was accepted by the Library of Congress in 1968 as Holocaust Jewish 1939 to 1945, whereas in most Holocaust laws, for example, those of California, Illinois, and Florida, the Holocaust is listed as 1933 to 1945. So this is not even in juxtaposition to the official usage of it in American lexicons. Now, if you look into a dictionary prior to 1968 in America, you won't find the use of the word Holocaust capitalized, meaning what it has taken on to mean subsequently, say with Elie Wiesel and other people who have pretty much promoted the idea. And it wasn't essentially until the 1980s with its implications of guilt and the blame that were scattered throughout the world, because these people who are refugees and had been in the Holocaust situation had, after a period of time, after they were able to reestablish their lives, began to develop a sense that the Holocaust needed to be revenged, not just on the perpetrators themselves, but on the rest of the world, whom they thought simply stood aside and watched what happened and did nothing. But let's get back to Maine. A group of people came into Maine, and along one of the most interesting historical landmarks, you might say, came about with the so-called Bitburg situation, in which then-President Reagan, this was around 1982-83, when President Reagan accepted a invitation to go to Germany and visit a cemetery called Bitburg. And unfortunately, Bitburg was where some SS soldiers were buried, and it was known that the SS were primarily responsible for running the death camps. I need not to go into that too deeply. But there was an unholy outcry, including many, many members of Congress and the Senate, who petitioned to have Mr. Reagan not go to Bitburg. Now, he went anyway, and he made a speech to this effect that there was no point in constantly badgering the Germans, especially when much of the older generation responsible for the Holocaust had already passed away. And there was no point in establishing guilt and blame on succeeding generations, which, of course, had nothing to do with it. Now, these people, many of these people who went to Maine, got jobs, they established lives for themselves, many of them became professors and teachers in various universities. And this particular group, around 1983 or 84, established what is known as the Maine Holocaust and Human Rights Center, consisting primarily of about 20 or so Holocaust survivors, just a handful of people. Now, again, if we want to say, how does anyone go about studying the incipient, the infection, if I may say, of parasitism, here is an excellent opportunity. Because within a short period of time, this group had ingratiated itself with the Maine legislature. It had ingratiated itself with the Department of Education. It invited a member of the Maine Department of Education to be on its board of directors, and it actually got funding from the legislature to establish a museum at the State House in Augusta, Maine. In subsequent years, they've also induced the governor of the state of Maine and his wife to endorse Holocaust exhibits at the Capitol, and in their annual meeting held at a very posh hotel in South Florida, South Portland, Maine, have actually had as their keynote speaker the chief judge of the state of Maine. So they this small group of people through primarily outside funding have been able to establish a tremendous amount of influence in the state of Maine. And they have, through the Department of Education, which they've essentially taken over, again, by way of deception, if I might add, have been able to push their paradigm of education into the public schools without practically any opposition whatsoever. And they give a continuing seminar at Bates College, which is up in Lewiston, Maine, which is which will not allow any outside or opposing point of view to be expressed on this particular campus, although it claims to be one of the outstanding small colleges in the entire country. So here we can see, perhaps, through a study of the influence of this particular group, the extent of parasitism that has been able to engulf the state of Maine, and how, through the use of shame and guilt, they have been able to essentially silence any kind of criticism. So here you have the use of shame and guilt to establish a parasitic situation over a much larger population by simply a handful of people. So here you have an actual example, perhaps, of parasitism, where essentially a humble host has been parasitized almost without opposition by a small group of parasites that have used all kinds of devices to gain control over the mind of the people of the state of Maine. So here we have a case where it actually can be studied, because we can actually see the transition that has taken place, the fact that they began at a certain time, and how through the operations of this organization, they have been able to essentially change the thinking of the people of the state, and essentially even pit the people against one another. So whereas this was a formerly highly ordered population, very, very law-abiding, there is now this outside influence, this parasitic influence that has come in here and literally changed the thinking of the entire population. And so this offers a good opportunity, perhaps, for academic investigation on the master's degree or PhD level. And I would highly recommend it to anybody who might want to take up this study.
Oh, absolutely. They're masters, criminal geniuses. They know divide and conquer.
Now, one of the interesting thing is that the parasite essentially wants to be as low profile as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And this group of people... I investigated them personally. It was extremely difficult to find out their names or where they were living,
mm-hmm.
Because they operate out of a box number with a paid non-Jewish executive secretary. So,
yeah.
You know, this is, again, by way of deception.
Well, they're also
master hypocrites. You have to dig out this information and make it available to the people, because so many people are so trusting in the host society that they have already been so thoroughly brainwashed that it's difficult to see, have them realize what is actually happening to them.
No, there is no greater person enslaved than he who thinks he's free. But they're master hypocrites in the sense that they want to be in the dark, working in the shadows, and yet they're the very people pushing for things like national ID and computer databases that contain everything about
you. Well, I mean, in my view, I mean, the Anti-Defamation League is the real scourge of this country. And they, of course, and it's easy to verify this. I have to go to their website. They're responsible for the hate crime laws. They're attorneys who are paid for by tax-free money, have written the hate crime laws, which have, in most cases, been brought into state and federal government without hardly changing a word.
Mm-hmm.
So this is unbelievable, you know, because to suggest that one group of people has a greater propensity to hate than any other group is an absurdity. And in my book, for example, I have a chapter on hate, and I suggest that hatred is a very vital emotion, almost essential for survival. If you go back in time when man was merely a hunter and gatherer, and without the sense of hatred and strong emotion that he must have had, he never would have been able to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we are now so-called in a civilized situation, it doesn't mean that hatred can be essentially bred out of humanity in one or two generations. This is a very deeply ingrained basic emotion that, of course, is not confined to man, but it's confined within the brain, the primitive brain, especially of all higher organisms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from dogs and cats and apes and chimpanzees and so forth. So, you know, this to use the term hate as a pivotal word in order to gain political power, and again, this is a device to gain power over the whole society, as is anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I was trying to point out, in my view, that if indeed Jews are parasitic, that anti-Semitism is simply a reaction of the host to having been parasitized, rather than the reverse,
sure,
is what many Jewish writers would suggest.
Yes, it's a form of survival. Philip, are you aware of what the Kol Nidre prayer is?
Well, I'm not very well versed in religion of any type, for that matter.
I bring it up because you said that in order for the parasite to succeed in continuing to drain the lifeblood from the host, which is what's happening to us, deception is key to their battle plan. And the reason
this is true. I mean, if you want to study any parasitic host relationship, whether it be with insects, paramecium or ants or whatever, it is essentially the same.
Mm-hmm.
The host goes, I mean, the parasite goes to great length to disguise its intent. And of course, the very best parasite is one that can remain alive and continue to provide sustenance to the parasite for a long period of time. I mean, if the parasite simply kills off the host, then it has to search for another host in order to survive.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I bring that up is the Kol Nidre is a prayer that the Jewish people say once a year,
uh-huh,
and they say it this weekend.
Uh-huh.
It's during Yom Kippur, and Kol Nidre is all oaths. And in that prayer, when they're in synagogue, they basically say music. I think it's the music that they pray this prayer, and it basically disavows any oath that they're going to take in the next 12 months to any non-Jew. So,
this is certainly a deceptive.
Yes, it is the height of hypocrisy,
yeah,
when a Jew goes into a courtroom or enters government and places his hand upon a Bible or even a Talmud, which most of them now, they refuse to put their hand on the Bible. They're putting it on that filthy thing called a Talmud.
Mm.
And at the same time, they know they have prayed this Kol Nidre, which says that any oath that they take is disavowed already.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt that having looked at various meetings by Jewish jurors on the internet and having read their statements with regard to a comparison of the Talmudic law to that of the Constitution, I suspect that every Jewish juror would like to substitute the Talmud for the Constitution, and indeed this is an ongoing attempt by many of them, despite what many of them have said.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, is essentially devoted to the upholding of the First Amendment, and yet I think essentially, again, most of the Jews, and it's that's mostly populated by Jews and run by Jews today, have the notion that, that the Constitution should eventually be substituted by the Talmud. So that all that they're saying about supporting the First Amendment is, again, deceptive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I feel very badly if this indeed is true, which I think it is.
But
you asked me earlier, what does the Post do about a situation
right.
when the realization comes about that they're being parasitized? Well, of course, if you look at the animal world, there have been all kinds of devices brought about to attempt to mitigate the effect of the parasite or even to alleviate it. And, of course, human beings having a brain can, once they become aware that this indeed is a situation that has to be dealt with, there are two ways to deal with this thing. Either on the basis of dialogue or on the basis of essentially renouncing the parasite and demanding that the parasite no longer exercise its parasitic ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having looked at a great many utterings of many rabbis, it seems to me that there's virtually no opportunity for any kind of dialogue, because the laws, Talmudic laws and so forth, are so ingrained in their society that even changing a period or a comma requires a very agonizing reappraisal. So I think it's just that the host should become more and more aware and be able to face the parasite down and don't be dismayed when the term anti-Semitism or bigotry and prejudice is directed against them, because again, these are all means of maintaining the parasitic way of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, whereas with animals and plants, they do it, say, chemically or mechanically in some way. In the case of human beings, it's done through verbalization.
Well, tell the folks what you're doing down there in your case as an example of how to fight back.
Well, for example, after having looked into the Holocaust law, which was passed in 1994 here in the state of Florida, which required the Holocaust to be taught in the public schools, and having read the law and having determined that the law was derived almost word for word from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is funded by American taxpayers, it was introduced in the Senate and the House by Jewish legislators almost word for word, and when it came up for discussion in committee, there was practically no discussion with regard to the implications of the bill whatsoever, and so forth. And then when it was brought before the legislature for a vote, it was passed unanimously. Now, of course, if you go to a non-Jewish legislature and you say, why did you vote for this law? You will find that they are very well aware that during the time that this bill was being considered, the newspapers were full of statements like a veiled warning, any legislature not voting for this bill will be, shall we say, dealt with at some later time, meaning that the full force of the Jewish machine in that particular state or precinct or wherever it might be, that the chance of that person getting reelected would be very, very small. I mean, a good case of that is former Representative Finley from Illinois, who was defeated by the Anti-Defamation League and the Student Hillel organization when he ran for the reelection. You know, there's a very keen sensitivity that anybody who takes issue with something like this, regardless of the implication of it in the public schools, would be traumatized in some way. Not only, I mean, we find that people who have opposed Jewish legislation in the past have been not only, say, defeated and they re-ran for office, but also they've been pursued by the Anti-Defamation League and other Jewish advocacy groups to the extent that any time they even apply for a job, that a possible employer is been inundated with information, telephone calls and whatever from the Anti-Defamation League and other such organizations to not employ this individual as being an anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm.
So again, here you have the enormous pressure, a great deal of it, which is highly dubious. I mean, if people fought back, I think that that the influence of these organizations would be much less than it is now. I mean, there is a perception that goes way beyond the actual power of the Jews in this particular instance. So all it takes is a few instances where people have actually shown that they can stand up to them, and I think you'd see the entire thing begin to crumble.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my particular instance, I took the Department of Education to court because a task force appointed by the Commission of Education, Brogan, who is now, I might add, the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Florida, that's to my regret, he appointed a task force which was almost entirely composed of Floridians who were either victims of the Holocaust or the descendants of victims of the Holocaust. And they proceeded to write and implement this law at their own discretion without any professional oversight or any other thing by any other group or organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when they begin to have meetings of this task force, they are required under the state of Florida sunshine law to have open meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, which I wanted to attend. But every time I tried to attend one of these meetings, I was put off. And finally, I had to take them to court because they were violating the law. And not only that, but I have evidence of this because I got the state attorney from Miami, Dade County, in on this, and I have official verification of what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did take them to court, being employees of the state of Florida, they therefore could be represented by attorneys from the state attorney's office. And, of course, the chief one representing them was a Jewish attorney from Dade County. And I had already written to the judge saying that in view of the fact this was a suit involving the Jewish religion, I would oppose any Jewish attorney representing the state of Florida in this issue. So when we got into court, I'm not an attorney, but when we got into court, the attorney was there, the Jewish attorney was there, and the judge asked me, if I was on the other side of the aisle, if I still objected to having a Jewish member of the state attorney's office represent a client in this particular case. So being a very largest individual, I decided that I should let him represent these people. He was so shaken that he immediately stated that this is the first time in his entire career that his religion was ever called into question.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, he was so tongue-tied that he could hardly say anything. Now, when the judge, the entire point turned over whether or not this committee had actually observed the Sunshine Law.
Mm-hmm.
So when the judge asked the opponent if they indeed had observed the Sunshine Law and had open meetings, there was utter silence. So the judge smiled and said, well, I mean, that's quite evident, and you haven't observed the Sunshine Law. So he issued a court order requiring this task force henceforth to observe the Sunshine Law and announce their meetings in a state publication.
Yep.
However, since then, they have had virtually no meetings whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, simply, as far as I can see, to make sure that I don't understand.
Well, we're almost out of time. I'd like you to let folks know how they can get a hold of you to maybe help and or get information from you.
Sure. The best thing to do is write me at my publishing business, which is called Fiscary Press, and I'll give you the address of that, the box number.
here in Orlando, Florida. And by the way, Piscary, it's for those of you who wonder why I use this term. Piscary is a fishing hole, and another meaning of the term is that it is fishing in other people's waters,
okay.
Which I like to do.
Okay.
Well, anyway, it's Post Office Box 541151, Orlando, Florida, 32854-1151.
Okay, well, we're out of time, Philip.
Okay.
So thanks a million for being on.
You bet. A lot of fun.
You take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody, have a good Feast of Tabernacles, and we'll be with you next week, Yahweh willing. Take care, and Yahweh bless. Bye-bye.
In the beginning, when our hearts were free, we heard the voice inside us, followed the rhythm.